Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. A vast array of tank farms housing an even vaster array of toxic chemicals and fossil fuels lines the Willamette River as you head north along Highway 30 in northwest Portland. Known as Oregon's critical energy infrastructure hub, these tanks provide most of the fuel storage for the entire state. Since the release of the 2013 Oregon Resilience Plan, emergency officials have become increasingly concerned about the impact of the state's fuel supply following the damaging earthquake. But according to my guest today, these tank farms pose far greater risks than just a disruption of the fuel supply. Jay Wilson, Resilience Coordinator for Clackamas County Emergency Management, believes these tank farms are a ticking time bomb for a major environmental catastrophe. Jay, welcome to Locus Focus.
Good morning, Barbara. Thank you.
We're going to talk today about this very strange phenomenon in northwest Portland, which most people maybe notice but don't really think a lot about, and it's called Oregon's Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub. So, Jay, what is this hub, and how can you take notice of it when you're driving north on Highway 30?
When you're driving north on 30, you have to cross a lot of train tracks, and you see a lot of warehouses, and the West Hills are on your left as you're going, out towards the coast. If you're really not paying attention, you won't see that there's all these tanks that are just flying by on your right as you're going up towards the St. John's Bridge. For those who are a little more noticing of things like that, you'll notice those tank farms go on for a long time. And there's a variety of sizes and shapes, and some are newer, some are older. But I think people may not appreciate what that means for the state, what it means for the river, and what would ever happen if something went wrong around there.
Well, a couple of years ago, I was driving along Highway 30 going to a barbecue out on Sovie Island, and I had this guy in the backseat of my car. So as we were driving by, he was telling me what every single thing was, what was stored in this tank, what was stored in that tank. And that was the first time I really gave thought to just what was really in these tanks, as opposed to them just being an eyesore. So let's talk a little bit about what is in there and why are so few people aware of what's in those tanks?
I had the opportunity in 2019, I put together a presentation about the CEI hub for just that reason, to talk about the environmental aspects, not just the fuel resource threat that's there from an earthquake. And I talked to a gentleman named Richard Franklin, who's in the Portland EPA office, and he's the federal on-scene coordinator for them. And he knows this by the back of his hand. This is what he does. And he gave me a laundry list of things. It's not just oil. Of course, it is refined gasoline. There is diesel. But there's a number of other oil products there, and all kinds of things like kerosene and additives, as well as several tanks of ammonia, and I'm drawing a blank, but a number of other lethal chemicals that are held in that area too, as well as liquid natural gas. So it's quite a stew of things that are all co-located in an area that It's kind of amorphous in a way that you don't know what's in those things. For most people, they would never have any idea the nature of what's in those tanks.
As a Portlander, I have always thought, until I started learning more about this hub, that Portland was a pretty environmentally minded city and that we didn't have a lot of the kind of industrial and fossil fuel problems that are in other places like Richmond, California or Tacoma, Washington. I have these friends from Tacoma that I spent a lot of time with when I was working up there last year on a radio project. And they were coming to visit me, and as they were going over the railroad bridge, they looked down and saw all these tank farms. And when my friend got to the railroad station, she said, "You have many more tank farms than we have in Tacoma." So let's talk a little bit about these hidden secrets of danger here and how we don't know about them.
I'm fascinated about how hazards are aspects of where we live, and whether we're aware of them or whether they're a part of our sense of place or not. And and when it comes to talking about earthquake risk, there are so many things that are built out in places that are flat by necessity. They have to be, like airport. But these areas are often the worst locations for ground shaking and ground failure. That's the case out there along that stretch of the Willamette. Is almost all of the area where those tanks are built was originally open water or wetlands that were filled at the turn of the last century. And it was to maximize access to the river and probably rail as well. The nature of soils that fail in earthquakes have to do with it mostly being sandy or muddy and a very high water table. So the shaking that comes rolling through causes the ground to lose its ability to bear weight. And so, yeah, the foundations for those tanks, which were all built, almost entirely built with before we even had an earthquake code. I mean, it couldn't be much worse than it is right now in terms of the risk, the inherent risk for earthquakes to cause a huge problem there.
Well, another question is, why do we have so many of these tanks in Portland? And why would we have more storage facility for fossil fuel in one place here in Portland than they have in Tacoma?
I can only think that it's related to convenience, probably, that the lower Columbia River and then the deep water channel that allows big ships to come in to the port of Portland, and the pipelines that come from Washington that terminate there in that storage facility, where there's about 95% of Oregon's oil products are stored there. So it really is this huge concentration in one place that is a state asset. But the threat that anything happens to it is actually the state's problem as well. I think a lot of these things happen, they organically happen, but the risk becomes, you know, even more cumulative over time. And I think people just, you know, we didn't even appreciate the earthquake risk in Oregon really till just a couple of decades ago.
Actually, when the Loma Prieta earthquake happened in California in 1989, and the Oregonians started running all these articles about how Oregon was as much at risk for an earthquake as California was. And I didn't know much about that at the time. And I thought, why are you doing all this hysteria? We should be worrying about floods, not earthquakes. Of course, then a few years later, we started learning more about the Cascadia subduction zone. And I think most people now are aware that we live in a very serious earthquake zone. There's been a lot of talk about retrofitting the tank farms in the critical energy infrastructure hub. But is it really possible to retrofit all those tanks to a point where they'd be safe when there's just so many of them? Is there still a reason to have all of them together in one place?
That's a subject of several reports that have been done over the past few years and continue to be produced. Portland State University, for example, is very involved in testing the ground to see if there are ways to harden and stabilize the ground more during an earthquake, and especially for tanks that are already in site. Doing all of this for new construction is much easier than going in and doing it afterwards for something that's been there. And structurally retrofitting tanks from the 1930s through the 70s, which are the ones that hold the most oil, prior to even earthquake codes, means one, it's extremely expensive. And most of the time, those retrofits are really designed only to keep them from failing. It doesn't mean they're going to be reusable afterwards. There's a huge cost to make weak structures that are without earthquake codes to actually be performance-based and continue to operate. And so there's a cost issue, one, for that, but the other is the consequences of those things failing as they are now or possibly in the future. It's perilous for us.
Let's talk about what the specific dangers are around that region. You spell that out very well in this slideshow presentation, which I'm going to post on our website so other people can look at it. But why is this area a particular confluence of dangers?
Yes, it's an extremely dangerous place. The mouth of the Willamette River, besides all of the liquefiable soil that these tank farms and the bridges, the pipelines, the electrical infrastructure there is all concentrated in that area. But Highway 30 basically runs on top of and parallel to the Portland Hills Fault. which most geologists agree could produce upwards of a 6.5 to a 7 magnitude earthquake. The West Hills there are very landslide prone and could easily jeopardize the highway. But the threat of a fire being ignited in an oil-based disaster or something that would strike that area means that the Forest Park and those hills, too, are heavily forested. They could certainly be a wildfire danger. And then just the population who live adjacent to that area, both in, say, Linton, and then on the opposite side of the river, in St. John's and that Overlook neighborhood, all of those would be susceptible to being downwind of a plume that could come off of that area. Just the smoke itself, but any explosions. There's any number of reasons why it's a high hazard area for those adjacent to it, but downstream, if anything gets in the water too, like Sauvie Island.
And then all the way down to Astoria, actually.
All the way out to the ocean. I mean, that's the big point that I'm trying to make now. As the former chairman of the Oregon Seismic Commission and one of the co-lead authors of the Oregon Resilience Plan, most of the attention to this area as an earthquake risk has been the loss of the oil as a resource from an earthquake. And when we need the oil and the gasoline most, the facilities would basically be offline, and the risk would be we wouldn't have what we need to do emergency response. And that's kind of where the concern has stopped historically. And my biggest point has been the environmental impacts from the release of that oil. Even a fraction of that oil could be as big as the Exxon Valdez disaster from 1989, and that no one to date has done any form, consistent study of what that means, of what it looks like for the ecology of the lower Willamette and the Columbia River, and the impacts to, the environment, for people like the tribes, for tourism, for water access. There's a huge list of things that would be tied to that.
Well, we had sort of a wake-up call a few years ago when this truck drove off the road on Highway 30 and crashed into an asphalt train. I forget what the truck was carrying, but it was very flammable, and the truck burst into flames. And actually, interestingly, I was going to a party that night in Sauvie Island, and I had to go by way of St. John's because Highway 30 was just closed. And then coming back later that night, I could see all the damage, and the signs were melted, and it was really frightening. And plus, you could see the smoke, and the smoke was really intense, I know, for people in St. John's. Did that event wake up anybody in the emergency management areas of the state?
Well, I think a lot of people paid attention to it. I think that's exactly the kind of accident, the scale of a fuel-based accident that people train for. They're small, they're fairly contained. It's an amount of release that their incident plans are designed for. And every one of those facilities has registered with the fire marshal, and they train on what would happen if something went wrong. But there's not really a plan if there was a cumulative failure, if there was a cascading failure of multiple tanks. And that's been my main concern is when the earthquake happens, the ground shaking is going to be heightened on those types of soils. It's actually amplified several times. And so not only are they not designed for the earthquake, they're going to endure even harder shaking, longer shaking than many other things. But the containment basins around them that are there for what would be a typical spill are probably going to fail as well from what's called liquefaction and lateral spreading, where the ground actually moves and likely moves toward the river. And so, a release of just a fraction of what's currently on site could very quickly escalate to be a historical oil spill, right there at the mouth of the confluence of the Willamette and the Columbia.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Jay Wilson, who's Resilience Coordinator for Clackamas County Emergency Management, about Oregon's Critical Energy Infrastructure Hub. One of the things that struck a lot of people who were trying to stop all these oil trains that go through the gorge and then continue up along the Willamette River and the Columbia River up to Port Westward, was the concern that it was just a matter of luck that that truck struck an asphalt train instead of an oil train. And I wonder if these conversations are happening, because these are the things that people who are opposed to oil trains for all kinds of reasons, ranging from climate change concerns to safety concerns, that they look at that. But it seems like a lot of emergency management people are sort of stuck in a place back in history where they're not seeing the kind of ramifications that you're talking about.
I really believe that agencies like Portland Fire and the State Department of Environmental Quality and the federal EPA do take the risk for those types of situations very seriously. But, you know, I went looking through the contingency planning at a regional scale for massive disaster planning for release. I couldn't find anything. And that's what still is frightening, is that people aren't training for, you know, 10 million gallons to be released from a failure, or possibly more. And then post-earthquake, there's not a contingency plan for mustering the amount of effort that it's going to take to respond to that. I mean, even the Exxon Valdez disaster in Prince William Sound was enormous, and it took a huge amount of effort to get in there and work on it. But that wasn't following an earthquake. So this is where these cascading disasters and our assumptions just get blown out of the water, because most of the things we prepare for are on blue sky days, not following the worst earthquake in U.S. history that we then have to respond to.
Thinking about worst-case scenarios, I'm thinking how this past year has been a series of worst-case scenarios. And interestingly, the beginning of the pandemic, there was a relatively major earthquake in Salt Lake City, not a place that's used to having earthquakes. And aside from a very good friend of mine who's from Salt Lake, so he was following it, but we didn't hear that much about it. And I thought at that point, what a horrible thing. How do you deal with an earthquake when you have to socially distance and be in isolation? So as we're talking right now, I'm just thinking about, and I'm trying not to go there, of like, well, now we've seen, you know, so many things we couldn't imagine happening, this earthquake that we've been talking about. And we're just talking right now about a small earthquake. I'm wondering what happens if the great one, the big one that's going to be off the coast, which would be a 10 in Astoria and would probably be a 7 in Portland, how would that affect this area? And would that possibly make the West Hills Fault also active?
Yeah, I'll make a disclaimer right now. I'm not a geologist, so I don't know the details of how faults relate to one another, although they can sometimes release tension on other faults. But yes, certainly the coast is going to face the strongest shaking. But, you know, we'll face here in the Portland area a full 4 minutes or more of shaking, too, and it'll be strong. It may not be violent, but it's the duration of that shaking that's going to exceed the capacity of a lot of our systems to withstand that. And then it's the period of the shaking, too. The closer you are to where it happens, the shaking is much more high frequency and jarring, but the further away you get, it starts to be more rolling as the wavelengths spread out. And so that type of long, rolling, 4 minute long shaking, we don't really have codes designed for that. And especially when you have tanks that don't have earthquake integrity, full of heavy liquids that start moving, it gets some bad times bad over and over again. It's just, yes, this is the stuff that keeps me up at night.
I can imagine. Well, just to keep you up a little bit more, we talked a little bit a few minutes ago about what's in those tanks. And one of the things that jumped out to me is LNG, because a lot of us here in Portland, we've been really concerned about stopping the LNG terminal proposed for Coos Bay and also the smaller facility proposed for Tacoma. I don't know exactly how big this LNG facility in the port of Portland is, but it's not nearly the size of the other two that I mentioned. But it still brings a lot of concern, because LNG is really flammable. So what's your scenario for what would happen with that facility?
I haven't studied much on the LNG front in terms of how it responds to earthquake failures. I think there were some damages like that in Japan, in the Sendai area. But one thing I would say is that most of those facilities are much newer. If there's anything to take to heart, you know, Northwest Natural has really been busy doing a lot of that updating work and structural refinement. And so not to say that there wouldn't be sustained damages, especially on all the soils around the area, too, and for access purposes and pipelines as well. But I do believe at least many of their facilities are probably the strongest that are there in that area compared to the old, oil tanks. I know the PSU is still doing ongoing research in that as well, and they've been great at trying to unmask some of the nature of those tanks and what's in them and what their risks are.
Well, I want to start looking at what we do about this mess. And I know there's a lot of people who are calling for dismantling this hub and finding other ways to store the necessary fossil fuel and maybe figure out ways to not store some of it and get rid of it. What's your thoughts on the short term of dealing with it? Because this earthquake could happen any day, we know. And then what would be some of the long term hopes to sort of maybe change the whole paradigm?
Well, this is where I'll probably make a disclaimer that I'm not representing Clackamas County in talking about this subject, because these are my opinions, but they're very informed. I'm informed by having been the chair of the Seismic Commission and some work I did at the national level on climate resilience under the Obama administration, too. Yeah, I think what's really in front of us is an opportunity to shift direction. If all these facilities are in such dire need of being upgraded for an earthquake we know is going to happen, and there's already a lot of policy momentum going on between Portland, Multnomah County, and certainly the state towards reducing greenhouse gas emissions anyway, why can't you leverage seismic policy to benefit climate change policy and open up an economic opportunity going forward that doesn't rely on doubling down on oil infrastructure that's 100 years old? Stepping back away from this energy hub and all these tanks and divesting ourselves from the risk we have, to me, is a policy direction that seems perfectly aimed at this helps you meet your 2050 goals for reducing greenhouse gas emissions. But my frustration has been that most of the reports I've seen that have come from Oregon Solutions and the former commission I was on, the Seismic Commission, talk very little about how do you bring all these policy options together. They get more into the weeds on working with oil companies and technical fixes for the physical structures. Maybe they talk about relocating and, you know, having different areas where you have them. But I think the environmental risk that I'm now talking about puts an even bigger emphasis on we can't allow this to continue the way it is. No action as an alternative is actually the very worst thing we can do. And to me, the best thing is to use this as an opportunity to build on reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And so therefore, let's limit what we do there rather than double down on it.
Well, I got a taste of the difficulty that we might have with getting the oil companies to really change the way they think and behave. Back a few years ago, when the city of Portland was approving its ban on future fossil fuel infrastructure, and there was a big debate about whether there should be an allowance for existing infrastructure to increase in size as much as 10%. And environmentalists and the students, the wonderful students from Lincoln High School and Sunnyside Environmental School, were making very articulate arguments about why that was not good and there should be no expansion at all. Right after their arguments, this guy comes up from Kinder Morgan and basically says that 10% isn't enough. They need at least 25 or 30% increase in order for it to pencil out for them financially. So Amanda Fritz, who was then on the city council, said, "So you're saying that 10% is not enough?" And he says, "Yes, it's not." So she said, "Well, maybe we shouldn't have any at all." And then that changed the conversation back to what the students were arguing. But it really gave me a sense of just how stubborn and committed to the past Kinder Morgan and all the other oil companies that are there. And we can throw Zenith into the mix now too. So is there any way that you can see of working with these oil companies, or do we have to find a way to go around them?
I think we have to set our own path and not be dependent on reconciling what we want with the oil companies. I mean, that's my opinion. And I think it's just, there's a slide that's in that presentation I have where I had taken a photograph from Highway 30 of a bunch of these tanks, and I tried to do a literal silo identification of why it's so challenging to work in this arena and find some common ground, because there are so many different levels of interest and funding and authority. This has been one of the biggest frustrations, is trying to break through this impasse with the oil companies and their respective associations. And there's all these anti-trade laws that get in the way. And so, like Amanda Fritz, I think the better thing to do is just go around this problem and circumvent it. And if we can divest from our need to have them there in the first place, I think we'll be setting ourselves up for a lot of easier options going forward.
Just looking at the path that the Portland's ban on fossil fuel infrastructure had to go through, I mean, the Business Association, a Business Alliance, and some other oil companies and groups appealed the ordinance, and it went through LUBA and basically was pretty much upheld with a few changes. But it's like 2 years later. I don't know that Portland has actually finalized that famous ban on fossil fuel infrastructure, which we've been celebrated around the country for enacting. But we saw Zenith come in and expand their oil train facility while this infrastructure ban was basically being litigated. So how do you see that we actually move forward in some kind of constructive way? And speedily, because we're running out of time.
I was heartened by a couple of news articles just in the last week. Bloomberg had a huge headline that peak oil is suddenly upon us on November 30th, and saying, you know, 2019 was it. It's done. Based on everyone working from home and the travel restrictions, we've all demonstrated, you know, that in fact we don't have to have the consumption of oil that we thought we had. And it's kind of a big eye opener there. But there was a recent report that came out of the Lancet that was really having a public health scientist from across the world say, it's not just climate change, it's human health. There's all these health impacts from fossil fuels. You know, why can't we draw down our dependence on them? And especially for the 2050 timelines, the UN even, you know, was just saying that that this is humanity versus the Earth, you know, something like that, just calling on us. So I feel like there is a lot of momentum. And with the new administration coming in, I hope that alternative energy, alternative transportation, that a lot of these kind of options that are out there bring more and more light, that we don't have to cling to 100-year-old oil technology for our economy.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Jay Wilson, Resilience Coordinator for Clackamas County Emergency Management, about Oregon's critical energy infrastructure hub. Yesterday, I was walking with a friend in our neighborhood in Selwood, and we were talking about the things that we're sort of enjoying about the pandemic and the shutdown, and there's a lot we're not enjoying, but we are enjoying the peace and quiet and lack of cars, and the air has gotten cleaner again. There was a period where things seemed to be going too much back to normal, but now that we're shut down again, there is this quiet, and as someone who's been working at home for a very long time, it hasn't changed my life, but it makes me wonder if all these people who are working from home now might realize how nice it is, and maybe that this will become a new mode. And I wonder if this way to make use of the pandemic to sort of look into a new future where we aren't so dependent, as you were talking about, on driving in cars or even riding in gasoline-powered buses, and how we can start to really shape everything about our society and our culture that moves in a direction away from fossil fuel dependence.
I think that there's so many lessons that we can draw from this year. I mean, the pandemic has been kind of almost a reset button in a way for what we thought we had to have in order to do business, in order to conduct an interview, you know, like we're having right now with Zoom. But the social equity and social justice issues that emerged during the summer, I think, are also a huge groundswell for having equity be a central issue and theme in everything we do on top of that. And the issues of the CEI Hub's threat has so much environmental justice, social justice issues for communities that are, going to be affected by this. And I can't help but think of the native, the tribes that depend on the river that may be directly and indirectly impacted. And just thinking in terms of multi-generational planning, I think it's incumbent on us to not make our children and grandchildren inherit this problem. You know, we really are at a decisive point to turn this around. And I think, you know, for them, we should start working on this immediately.
Okay, so let's start right now. So what do you want to do? Actually, seriously, what do we need to do first to start moving away from this incredible threat that's like breathing down our throats every single day here in Portland?
In the presentation I have, I focus on trying to reconcile all of these conflicted policies and leveraging them to get to where we need to go. I've adopted a term from several earthquake reconnaissance visits I've made about having recovery-informed planning, so that you know that if something bad happened, you wouldn't go back and do things the way they are, the way they've organically changed. You might not rebuild all of that stuff where it is right now. So in knowing that, why don't you go ahead and deal with that problem now rather than waiting for it to become exponentially worse in the midst of an earthquake? It's just like the Burnside Bridge replacement that the Multnomah County is undertaking. You know, having a good bridge that's going to continue to work and serve the community after the earthquake is a much better long-term investment than saying, we'll fix it after it's broken, and then you don't have a bridge when you need one. And so for me, that's elevating resilience into a community value. And that community value means that now you're going to roll your sleeves up and look around and say, you know, in doing the good work now, it actually enhances everything going forward. And the dividend is we won't have this problem when the earthquake happens. And so it's really broadening your horizon to think how the disaster actually leverages you to get to where you want to go anyway.
As you're talking about the Burnside Bridge, I was just imagining the old Burnside Bridge, which now crosses the Sandy River, right where the Portland's water pipe, which used to also cross the river above ground, but they've moved that underground, which makes me feel a lot better since I learned about the earthquake. But I'm thinking about that bridge and imagining what it was like when that was the Burnside Bridge, and I guess it was replaced sometime in the 20s or 30s. We've already done that. I mean, the Burnside Bridge that we are familiar with now is a far cry from this beautiful kind of trestle bridge that's now crossing the Sandy River. But we can see that that bridge would not service the present. So I just wonder about if we take the Burnside Bridge that is now and envision what that's going to be like, and then think about how that might relate to the fossil fuel tank farms and how we can think about them in the future.
I've championed the Burnside Bridge conversation that the county has been holding at kind of a public hearing level for listening sessions, because I do think that it's an example of making resilience a conversation starter. And this is where the will of the public and the will of the elected officials can actually come together around this issue. And so enhancing the performance and the integrity of that bridge means that, when the earthquake happens, not only will it serve emergency work, but people can get back and forth to school. People can get back and forth to work. People can feel that they can live in a neighborhood that won't be isolated. In fact, the new bridge is going to have all these other amenities with additional bicycle lanes and things like that that are day-to-day benefits. But when the earthquake strikes, it's actually going to stand up and deliver a service that we would have lost otherwise. And so when you can bring resilience in as a value that everyone shares and can feel are justified investments, that's the kind of conversation I think we really need to start bringing to the CEI Hub. But in order to do that, everything's got to be on the table. And right now, the environmental catastrophe that would happen is not on the table. And this is where I think a lot of the environmental activists who are against, you know, kind of big oil and doubling down on this, there may not be still a good understanding of how the earthquake issue helps elevate their concerns and how a lot of these things actually do work together and tie together. And so in all of the new reports that are coming out, they're mostly looking at technical solutions and not policy options, and how the CEI hub needs to be a focal point, I believe, for the governor's argument in 2030 and 2050 timelines. But it's, as far as I know right now, it's not.
So how do we connect these two things? I know they're very much connected in your mind, and they're connected in the minds of a lot of people that I'm working with right now who are dealing with Port of Portland issues and trying to envision a green port and a port that that sustains and supports the community as opposed to decimating it. But how do we get these visions to the place at the table that you're talking about?
Well, I know the city and county, Portland and Multnomah County, have started having listening sessions in places like Linton and St. John's. I was actually invited to give this presentation to Salvey Island Grange, but the COVID got in the way of that. But I think the people who are most invested in their location near this should be the ones who are the most outspoken too. But the impact of the loss of this isn't just a Multnomah County and Portland problem. It's actually the whole state's. And in fact, I've been working on an updated blog posting where I'm trying to characterize this right. Oregon Department of Geology in their 2012 report has labeled this the Achilles heel of Oregon in this earthquake. If this facility goes down or is offline, it will be our Achilles heel to getting back in recovering. And for me, sure, it's that, but it's also, it's a Pandora's box to build on that mythology of if that bitch's brew that's in all of those tanks goes into the river, this is going to be the catastrophe for the entire Pacific Northwest. I mean, we share that river with Washington, but 5 days down the road, when all of that oil goes out the mouth of the Columbia, it's going to cover the beaches that are tsunami affected. And the shipping channels are all going to be immediately closed. And so the consequences just start spiraling and snowballing in terms of all of the secondary and tertiary impacts that this is going to have. We can't allow an oil spill on top of an earthquake and a tsunami. I mean, it's a reason why I've called this our Fukushima for a number of years now. It's not radioactive, but there's decades of contamination and a downturn to the economy that we'll be facing just because we've neglected to deal with this problem.
Well, I guess my question is how do we start having this conversation? I mean, you're talking about the listening sessions that are happening. And I know that this group that I've been working with, Braided River Campaign, is talking specifically about these issues and other issues and folding it into the whole question of environmental justice and issues around climate change. But I just wonder when particularly the emergency management people, and you talked a little bit earlier about what you were saying is your own opinion and it's not the opinion of the Clackamas County Emergency Management where you work. How do we get not just Clackamas County Emergency Management, but Multnomah County and the rest of the state to be dealing with the consequences of not doing anything and starting to have a strategy of what we're going to do, like, you know, a timeline of this is going to happen when?
Well, I've referenced a few reports in the last couple of years from Portland and Multnomah County that's, I think, shown some very positive results of they're able to draw down their gasoline dependency and usage while they've had an increase in population and an upturn in their economy. And so the idea that those cancel each other out or you can't grow an economy while using less fuel is kind of a false point. And so if a lot of the car manufacturers are shifting towards electric vehicles, if the city has an electric vehicle plan, and we've got an incoming administration that's very open-minded about all of these alternative opportunities, I just think there's a lot of momentum that's building for this conversation to happen. The point being is, I think the CEI Hub to me is this case study that could barely be at a national level of how we're because the situation is so dire. I feel like we have the justification and the leverage once we can put this on the table to actually say this is a huge pivot point, that it's not just a Portland and Multnomah thing, but it needs to be elevated, you know, all the way up the line to have this broader conversation of where do we want to be in 10, 20, and 30 years.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And we're talking today with Jay Wilson, who's the Resilience Coordinator for Clackamas County Emergency Management, about Oregon's critical energy infrastructure hub. So I'd like to just talk in the last part of the show about some specific things, particularly I'm just imagining dismantling those tanks. So the first question is, what happens to what's in those tanks if you get rid of those tanks?
You know, I'm not an environmental engineer in that sense. I know, for example, that there's a Portland Harbor Superfund project, and there's a huge collective of people who are involved in that. And I would imagine that something on a similar scale, if not bigger, would be involved in overseeing, you know, the nature of how these things are disassembled, deconstructed, and the sites and soils are cleaned up and rehabilitated. In fact, I think there are plans underway to try and think about long-term green futures for those brownfields that would be there and opening all of that up. I would imagine that there's probably a number of those tanks that are both not cost-effective to repair, are the worst offenders in terms of being a site for a spill. You strategically could probably start thinking of which ones could you take offline and not replace. And maybe you could, if you had to have a transition period, you know, supporting and strengthening the ones that are the best performers, that are the newest, or that can be a transition time, you know, that might be a strategy. I think this is where the importance of having the right people at the table to formulate a way, but it's your vision at the end is let's work our way out of this spot that we're in. And how do you get there?
I know that this group, the Brady River Campaign, has been working with the city around what they call the Economic Opportunity Assessment, which is reviewed every 10 years or so, and they're working on the latest revision of it. And what this group is trying to do is to get the city, the Planning Commission, to think about other things besides jobs, and that jobs also is equal to fossil fuel development, and to think about other ways to have jobs, but also integrate jobs with the kinds of things you're talking about, which a lot of it has to do with creating a much more green reality and thinking about renewable jobs, and also thinking about having more open space and more natural spaces restored to the port. But it's a very frustrating process. It's hard enough just to get into that process. And this group has had some success so far, but I'm not sure how much the city is really wanting to change the way they do business. And it's usually the same players that are at the table who have the leverage. Do you have any sense about how to change that picture so that more of us have more leverage?
Yeah, I know that there's a group that's looking at the charter of the city and possibly changing the makeup. And I personally feel like that would be a good direction for the city of Portland to change the form of government. I know how, as someone who's been in the middle of very contentious town halls and had to, you know, be the face of the county when there's been a flood or a problem, it's certainly not easy trying to represent, you know, issues with some integrity when there's just so much outrage. But I think for this particular issue especially, I think there needs to be more awareness and outrage because of the consequences of where we're at right now.
I think that the community of Linton and the community of St. John's have a lot of outrage. And just to see the way people came out against this proposed drone testing facility Verizon wanted to put just north of Cathedral Park, right along the river. And they withdrew that because there was so much community opposition. Most of that community opposition came from the communities. There was some support from other people in other parts of Portland. But I wonder how you see getting the rest of the region, including Clackamas County, where you work, to take up arms with the people who are most directly affected by the CEI hub and by the other kind of environmental atrocities that are being committed by the Port of Portland and its tenants along the river.
I've given this presentation to the Board of Commissioners in Clackamas County, and the point I was trying to make to them is that at least a direct impact if these facilities failed was that tidal influence on the Willamette River goes all the way up to the base of Willamette Falls, just as it does all the way to Cascade Locks. And so, all of those areas could see an oil slick coming upriver, you know, following a big earthquake and a failure of these facilities. But to say that's all that this means is just a small aspect of this. Addressing the demands that we have right now, I guess I'll just back up to where I was so moved by the protest of when the students all walked out last year, my daughter being one of them. And it's a slide I've pulled off in the presentation. And I think it's not responsible for the future of the children who are going to inherit this place for us to not take this seriously and see the bigger ramifications that way. And so it's not enough to just say, well, I'm not going to be hit by the oil slick. I think it has to have a strong sense of stewardship and leadership and ownership too. And there's a mindset, I guess, again, where resilience is something that you value and something that's integrated into all your decision making. And if the public wants that and appreciates it, then I would expect that the leadership is going to have to pay attention to that too. And maybe I'm just being really idealistic.
I'm thinking about the bad news right now. I was reading an article this morning about how only a quarter of Republicans believe that Biden won the election fairly, whereas I think 66% of Americans overall believe that the election was a fair election. So then I think closer to home, and I think about the county commissioner, I think the chair of the county commission in Clackamas County, who bragged about how she was going to have a huge Thanksgiving dinner for all of her friends and family and neighbors and just defy the governor's order. And I remember this woman from the last time she was on the commission before she got voted off. And I mean, she's a scary person. And she is one of the threads, political threads in Clackamas County that doesn't seem to want to go away. So while there's a wonderful movement of young people who get it and really want us to move, what do we do with the people like the Clackamas County Commission Chair, who are really wedded to this ideal? It's sort of an idealization of a really horrible past.
That's an issue that I think all of us folks who work in the realm that I'm in as a public servant have to find a way to work with and navigate the political landscape, whichever direction it's in, as our administrations change. I've been with the county for 12 years. I used to work for the state of Oregon, and then before that, I worked for FEMA. And there's a wide range of kind of political directions during that time. But I think there's a lot of people, like myself, who have commitments to serve the community and just believe that we're still there, doing the best work that we can, even though there are a lot of these kind of things come and go over time. And so I'm trying to adopt a position that I've recently heard called the radical middle. I don't know if you've heard of that or not. It was on a presentation I had seen with our county's climate exchange folks. But it was really trying, rather than being very far right, left progressive or far right conservative, and kind of how there's this kind of outrage on both ends, the radical middle is all about listening and trying to be inclusive and welcoming and appreciative, to the point of really being very transparent and process oriented, to allow a lot of equal representation and finding the common ground and the consensus between those things. And so it really requires a lot of patience, a lot of kind of long-term vision, and seeing the whole thing through. And I think in the tumultuous political landscape that we're in these days, the radical middle to me seems like a very good position to be in.
Well, it certainly sounds like it makes sense, and we're trying to figure out how to reach these people who believe that there's ones who believe there's a cabal of Democrats who are eating children and things like that, and that Trump is the savior. But I think it's really important, I agree, that we find ways that we really can communicate with people, and I think that starts by listening. But one last thing is, how do we listen to the young people? Because to me, they are such an inspiration, and they've been an inspiration throughout the summer leading the Black Lives Matter protests. And I think they feel something so deeply and so personally that those of us who are older are a little bit more intellectual about. So how do we take our leadership from them?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I got into the field that I'm in in disaster management by starting my college career wanting to be an environmental education filmmaker. And I grew up watching Jacques Cousteau and David Attenborough and, worrying for the rainforest. And I think that's always set with me in terms of that phrase that's been echoed so many times about thinking global and acting local. And as an emergency manager, it just hits home every single day for me, watching the wildfires that came tearing out of, the Eastern County in September. And the idea that that's going to be something we're going to be living with more and more, and the smoke, even for people who aren't directly affected, and just how, much all of us depend on this planet that we live on. It doesn't depend on us, but we depend on it, and it being healthy. And thinking about the, my 13-year-old daughter, thinking about her children, and having a sense of transition, through the generations. I think the more we can think in multi-decade planning, rather than just the next 4 years, is what's going to serve all of us best. And I think we need the children to bring that point back home again. That we inherited all of this built stuff from what was put there in the past 100 years to the post-war era, where there was so much built, but most of it's not built to the standards we need right now. And are we going to let our kids inherit all of that stuff that's probably going to fail in the earthquake that's part of being in the Northwest? To me, that's kind of where I am. I'm not just focused on being an emergency manager. When I embrace being someone who supports resilience, that threads through every single thing I'm interested in and I value, and just how I see the world.
Well, Jay, it's really great to talk to you. Thanks so much for being on Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara.
And keep up the good work. We've been talking with Jay Wilson, Resilience Coordinator for Clackamas County Emergency Management, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk with Kristen Eberhardt, author of Becoming a Democracy. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Oliver Mutsukuzi. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to wear a mask.
Chambera mambo.